And the subject, I'm sure this, the title of this afternoon discussion is fascinating to you all. How to stop talking. That's thinking, how to stop thinking. So this afternoon I've become very astute at this, because I could see early on in my efforts at meditation how incessant and relentless my thinking process was. And because I started meditating when I was 32, and been through the universities and the graduate school and so forth, so I was chock-a-block with ideas, thoughts, opinions, and views, and also, you know, with regards to the world, politics, religion, Buddhism, you name it, I had an opinion about it. And so became aware of the, you know, in the practice of meditation, how just these thinking habits would just keep reoccurring, you know, and disrupting, no matter how much I tried to control the mind, inevitably I'd end up with this wandering thinking. There used to be a cartoon in some meditation center with some yogi going to sit down and saying, "I'm going to practice meditation to reach a state of inner peace." And it shows this figure sitting in full lotus posture, and then think, and then think. And about four or five pictures later, it's this think. The whole body is covered with this word thing. And I think we can all relate to that as our experience. So we are a thinking creature, so this is not a function of the mind to despise. But we become victims of our ability to think. And where our education, our cultural conditioning, everything supports thinking as, you know, as a praiseworthy function. And to not think means, implies some kind of stupidity, usually. But thinking also becomes habitual. So then, like any habit, it's no longer very useful. We don't use thought, but we become victims of our thinking. And so when we try to meditate, then we want to know how to stop it. How can I stop thinking? And I remember in the early years of monastic life in Thailand, I remember vividly being at this branch monastery where I'd been living, and it was a beautiful place with a lot of hills and cliffs and grottos, and you know, I was very attached, very liked the place very much, but no matter how much I tried to control my thinking, it seemed to just be relentless, and you know, no matter how quiet and pristine the environment might be, or how tranquil external conditions could be, my mind was always in this state of activity. And so, and just trying to stop thinking was didn't work either. You know, as I remember determining, I'm going to stop thinking, just as an act of will, just will myself not to think, and I'd sit there and I couldn't do it for very long, I realized that willpower wasn't what was necessary, wasn't the way to do it, just because there was a desire, there was an insight into the value of not thinking, but then how to actually stop thinking or to let the thinking process cease. So like stopping thinking is usually an act of will in which we're kind of fed up and with our thinking and we just don't want to think anymore. And so there's a lot of negativity in that when you're just fed up with your mind and you just want to kill it off, not think anymore. That's a negative state. That doesn't work. Just negative desires to try to annihilate thinking. So of course this brings us to the essential point of Buddhist teaching, mindfulness, awareness. And of course this is to think about awareness and what is awareness and what is mindfulness. These words translating the Pali word sati sampatanya, sati panya. In Pali, of course, is a language that is dedicated to the analysis and understanding of the human conscious experience. And so sati generally is translated as mindfulness. But what is that? Mindful of... And what is mind? We can't even agree on how we're going to use the English word mind or consciousness. And so heart, you know, when we point to our emotions, we point to the heart. When we think of the mind, we point to the brain. It's got a good mind, meaning is has a good brain. And yet these words are pointing to the reality of human experience. And so not to let the words tangle you up. And you're never going to find words that are totally precise and adequate to describe anything whatsoever. Because life isn't like that. Life isn't dependent on words for experience, is it? It's learning to trust in the awakened conscious moment here and now. And so rather than, and that trust is not an act of will. You can't order yourself to trust and then do that. You know, it's a good idea and we're all for it, but trust is a heartfelt reality, not an ideal that we'd like to impose on the moment. So the awakening is the whole essence of the Buddhist teaching. And so, as I've said before, the word Buddha means awake. And so the word itself is significant, and that gives you the whole description of what the Buddhist teaching is really. All the volumes that you see in libraries, in internet, and bookshops, and whatnot, in all different kinds of languages. The whole point is a simple encouragement to wake up, be fully present here and now. And so we can understand the direction and try to practice that, but then the desire to think about it comes in. What am I doing? Am I really here and now? Am I really awake? We create ourselves endlessly in terms of assuming that we are some kind of real entity from the past. I have a history. I was born 70 years ago, and I have a birth certificate. Where, strangely enough, in those days, where I'm from, they didn't use fingerprints, they used footprint. So this right foot, and then everybody notices it's so big and swollen. It was only about that big on the... So I wasn't born with a big foot. But in terms of reflection, then this awaken here and now, this invitation to awaken, pay attention to life, then we reflect that this is all there ever is a moment here and now. Experience is now, consciousness is now, feeling is now, enlightenment is now. And thinking arises and ceases according to conditions. So when there's something to think about, and then we apply thought to maybe a particular effort we make in our profession, or repairing something in the home, or doing something specific. But so much of our life is caught in just wandering thought, in worry, planning for the future, feeling guilty about the past, and on and on like this. So the thinking process overwhelms us. We can be completely unawake in the present just by feeling guilty about something we regret in the past, which is a memory in the present, isn't it? So you can become very attached to that memory, and then spend your time in a state of negative obsession, of guilt, remorse, self-aversion, self-condemnation, just because of thinking. If you stop thinking, the feeling would go away. You perpetuate it by thinking about it. You can think about it in terms of logic and reason, and analyze it. You can blame yourself, seeing that you were very wrong and you were the bad one that said the thing you shouldn't, or didn't do the thing you should have. Or you can blame others, somebody else's fault. But all this is still thinking, and so thinking needs to be understood, its function, its purpose, and how to use thought, how to use language, because it is a valuable tool. It's a great gift, having a retentive memory, being able to remember, being able to learn, to retain information, to analyze, criticize. When I'm giving these reflections, it is not a condemnation of this, but recognizing how much suffering we create when we don't understand what we're actually doing, when we're lost in our own ignorance about thought itself, about emotional habits, the basic delusion we have about ourselves, seeing ourselves as a kind of permanent person, and that we make value judgments regarding to ourselves. We consider ourselves, in various ways of positive, negative values. So you find in modern affluent societies like this one, there's an enormous amount of suffering around guilt, worry. People are incredibly worried all the time, anxious, frightened, resentful, angry, and because this is all brought about through thinking. When you stop thinking, it all drops away, actually. So how to stop thinking? Well, if you notice, then I think, like Alzheimer's disease, where you lose your memory. Imagine if you lost your total memory, it'd be quite peaceful. In fact, years ago, I met a famous Christian monk in Berkeley, California, Father Bede Griffith, who was an English monk, Catholic monk. And he established an ashram in India. I visited there last year in Tamil Nadu. And he was a kind of visionary, kind of a Catholic monk, and he was a super brain, super intellectual. He had a brilliant mind, very learned, and he also adapted Catholic worship to Indian culture. So you go there to Shantivaram, his monastery in Tamil Nadu, and it's you think you were in a Hindu ashram. And the monks wear kind of saffron robes and shaven heads, things like that. And I haven't been to Mass for years and years and years. I attended morning Mass, the Eucharist, every morning. It's quite beautiful the way they Indianized it, I found. But anyway, this Father B. Griffith died many years ago, but before he died, I met him in a Korean Zen center in Berkeley. And so I wanted to, I heard he was there, and so I went to this place, and they said, well, he's up in his room, but you can go upstairs and see him. So I went there, climbed up the stairs, went into his room. There were his lying in his bed. And he was a very beautiful-looking old monk, actually. He had white beard and very rosy complexion. And he looked, you know, he looked very, very happy. And so he called me over to the bedside, and he told me that he'd recently suffered a stroke and lost most of his memory. And he said, "What a relief!" And he looked very, very happy. And this shows the man that has contemplated the nature of his mind, because to most people that would be very frightening, wouldn't it? Be very threatening. You're getting senile, or you're losing your faculties, or, you know, it's like a disgrace or something terrible happening to you. But he didn't see it like that at all. And I could understand what he was saying, you know, that actually he found a lot more, his life more peaceful, because he didn't remember so much. And he must, you know, and he was incredibly well educated and had written very scholarly books on religion, theology, and all kinds of subjects. So in meditation techniques, when we're training our mind, when you go through meditation training, we usually, one thing you begin to notice when you start with just watching the breath, what they call anapanasati, mindfulness of the breath, when you're actually with concentrated on something physical like the body, you're not thinking. So you can, when you begin to notice gentle feeling of the breath at the nostril, then and follow it, inhaling, exhaling. You're actually not thinking. There's awareness, consciousness, awareness. But during that moment, the mind tends to wander. So we oftentimes in our tradition we use a mantra to hold the attention onto the breath, because we're not used to not thinking. And the mind easily wanders into some kind of thought. So we use in the Thai forest tradition, we use the Bhutto mantra, which is the Buddha, name of the Buddha. So in Thailand they say, now when you inhale, you think to yourself, Bhut, exhale, To. And that's a technique to help sustain awareness onto the breath for people that cannot stop the thinking process. So then the mantra itself, chanting mantra, these kind of techniques that you find in Buddhism are also ways of thinking, but concentrating the thought into a two-syllable mantra such as Bhutto is you're using one word rather than than thinking about Buddha, or deciding whether there is a Buddha or not, or whether Buddha is in you or outside. You give up all these kind of questions and metaphysical speculations to just use the thinking process to tie it, bind your attention to a simple function, bodily function such as breathing. And then they, in the Burmese tradition, Mahasisadhu tradition, they usually contemplate the rise and fall of the abdomen. And so they don't use butto, they use rising, falling, you know, just to keep the attention on the when your abdomen is rising and when it's falling, you sustain. That's a way of holding your attention onto it. I also used butto in the. I found that when I first started meditation, I couldn't do anapanasati. I just was such an obsessed thinker that I just felt totally frustrated with trying to stay with the breath. So I used mantra for the first few months, and I found that very significant. Like this was before I met Lumpa Cha when I was a samanera in Nongkai. I had an insight that I needed to let go. So I used just those two words, let go, as my mantra. So I couldn't even stay with the breath. So I just decided that I'd use these two words because they meant quite a bit. They had kind of important message, significant to me at that time. And so I visualized these words just to make it interesting, because anything like that can get mechanical and perfunctory. So it doesn't help to just say let go, and then you get into a perfunctory drone. That doesn't work either. So the main is to keep your attention fully with the mantra. So when you start out, your attention is with it, let go, and to keep it from drifting into just mechanical recitation, I would start visualizing, like in neon lights. I'd see it written in my mind. I'm good at colors. I see colors very well. So I'd make beautiful colors in my mind with neon, let go. And it worked, actually, because I could sustain just by keeping it interesting for me enough to where, my attention was totally absorbed into this. At first I found that I just couldn't do it in a kind of normal rhythm, like with the breath. I had to actually think to myself, let go, in a very rapid kind of staccato style, just because of the way my mind worked. So I'd inwardly say I was living alone in a hut, but I would be thinking, I keep this as a kind of high-pitched staccato, let go, but fully with what I was doing. Eventually, I began to notice that the wandering tendencies were lessening, and then I could slow it down, and then eventually I could apply it to the inhalation, exhalation. So this is just a way of experimenting. Each one of us has our own peculiarities, and so you have to know how, take into account what your obstructions are, where you need to put your attention, because the things that always work for one may not work in the same way for somebody else. So it's developing upayas, or skillful means. Much of meditation is developing appropriate means at a particular time where the main method maybe isn't working, or you're really stuck or obstructed in some way, blocked off. So through this, letting go practice, eventually I'd have long periods where the mind was quite empty. You know, just be, suddenly the whole thinking process would stop for a while. There'd be this kind of space. And I'd notice this. Now this is very important to consciously notice non-thinking. So in doing this, you're trusting in the awareness of the moment, so which is this state of poised attention, attentiveness, here and now, and you're observing. You're looking, say, inwardly at this time. You're observing your mind, your mental state. Another method I found very helpful was to notice to deliberately think a sentence, but with the attention on the spaces between the words. So I would take some kind of uninteresting sentence, like, I am a human being. And so that sentence seems so kind of banal and ordinary, it doesn't interest me particularly in itself, in the actual words, but I wasn't interested in trying to figure out whether I am or not, but just taking a sentence and then, but with the attention before I think it, so I'd deliberately be thinking. The intention was to deliberately think this one thought. And before I would think it, and there'd be a gap, there'd be a hesitation. No thought there. And then I'd deliberately bring I into consciousness, and then there'd be another gap. Am, then there'd be another gap. A, another gap. Human, another gap. Being, and then there's quite a gap after being. So, or you could just stop it in mid-sentence, just because you're consciously affirming the space between thoughts, rather than being fascinated by what you're thinking or just wandering off in habitual ways with the thinking process. And in Pali they have a word called papancha, which means conceptual proliferation. And so conceptual proliferation sounds doesn't have the same punch that papancha does. But anyway, it's pointing to habitual thinking. And you notice how thinking works. You start with, you get caught in some thought, and then one thought connects to another. And it goes on. So, I mean, we used to play these games when we were children, party games, where somebody starts out with something, and by the time it gets back to the same person, the subject that they started with is completely changed. And just remember that, of how papancha just is this. We can start with thinking, well, what color should I repaint this room? And then in 5 minutes I'm thinking about what I need to take with me to Bhutan in November. And no connection, but somehow the mind will wander off like that. So the nature of thinking is to wander. So when we say we have a wandering mind, remember that's because of the thinking process. The one thought connects to another, and then it stimulates memory, or we feel somehow one thought will bring up some feeling which will start thinking in that direction. And so we can wander and wander through our whole life in our world of thoughts. So, but the space around thought is generally not consciously noted. We don't notice. Not that we don't have it, we never consciously appreciate that. So much of our culture is to think, to have think tanks, and to solve every problem through analyzing it and thinking about it. So that the modern education is all about thinking, developing thought, memorizing, memory, acquiring knowledge, where the aim of Buddhist meditation is almost the reverse, is letting go of all that, to recognize pure intelligence, pure consciousness, that isn't conditioned, it isn't culturally influenced, like consciousness at this moment. It's not a cultural condition. What we put into consciousness can be very cultural, personal. Can be right or wrong, good or bad, high or low. But the actual consciousness that the thoughts arise in is not condition. It's natural function. It's intelligent. It's universally intelligent. So it's not like it's not. You can't claim it on a person as some kind of personal intelligence. So it's in the Buddhist teaching is this awakening. Through this awakening here and now in the present, we begin to recognize or realize what is natural to us within this human form and our conscious reality that we're experiencing here and now. So the gaps between thoughts, words, and I found that deliberately thinking was I found that very helpful to me, because it made it very clear and very conscious of the emptiness. Where there's consciousness, awareness, but non-thought. It's like in this, so this is a reflection on reality of the moment. So you begin to just recognize and consciously notice. It's this way, emptiness or non-thinking, non-grasping, non-self. There's not a self in it either. As soon as I start thinking about me in some way, then I create myself into consciousness and I become a person, my personality. Then as awareness increases, I've been teaching this meditation on the sound of silence. And this I became aware of in the early years when, listening to the sound of silence, I hear this. So if we could turn off this, it's over there somewhere. Behind. It's going to suck me up into the attic. Because as I began to be more aware and awareness increased, then I began to notice this resonating vibratory, is it a sound or what? But it's the background. I noticed that when I was actually staying with this, just being in this state of awareness, that this was very peaceful. That the self is gone, the worrying tendencies, all the willful attempts at meditation dissolve, and all the rest, the kind of torture that a monk can make around meditation, about being a monk, and about Buddhism. And I mean, because even though you're living in a good situation, the tendency is to create problems in the mind. And to the way we hold Buddhist meditation also, it sounds very complicated and difficult. There's so many techniques and methods and teachers and so forth, so that when we read a lot and try to figure out how to meditate according to oftentimes scriptural authority or commentaries, you end up with a feeling, I don't think I'll ever be able to do that. Because the thinking process is one that complicates. Meditation is ultimate simplicity. So the more we try to, talk about meditation and describe it, then it becomes increasingly more complicated. And so that's why meditation retreats or workshops and that are attempts to not to discuss meditation, but to actually practice it, to give occasions where you can actually be supported in just being with yourself for a few minutes and looking inward, beginning to get that message of noticing, of awakened awareness, where you're not just perpetuating the old habits of thinking and analysis. So when during that time, I did notice this in this sound of silence, and I didn't know what it was. It wasn't particularly a subject that was mentioned in Buddhist texts. I was aware that when I'm in this state, there is no self. And previously, when I was 19 years old, I did have a kind of mystical experience when my mind actually, the thinking mind, just packed up all of a sudden. It wasn't due to drugs or anything, it was natural occurrence in a Christian monastery in California. So just suddenly the whole... When you're 19 years old, it's a very painful time for a young man, because you're so self-conscious and you're not really adult yet. And yet I was in the military, and I was in the Navy at the time, and there was so much kind of things going on and pressures on to me, and lack of confidence, and this endless self-critical tendency, it suddenly dropped. Then I was completely, and with this kind of resonating kind of sound, and I thought, I'd like to be like this all the time. And this is really nice, not beat anybody. And suddenly being 19 years old, being in the Navy, and being self-conscious, all of that completely vanished. And of course it was a timeless experience. I don't know how long it was, because it was timeless. But eventually I had to go back to the naval base, and then of course the old habits came back with a vengeance, and I didn't know what had happened. But it did, I consider that an awakening experience, actually, because 2 years later I came across Buddhism, and something in me immediately kind of understood Buddhism in a way, not in intellectually, but intuitively. So I've pursued that ever since, as a Buddhist path. But the first year living in the UK, 1977, we lived in Hampstead, near Hampstead Heath in London. And this was a very difficult year, because coming out of the northeast Thai forests and to live in this huge European city in a townhouse, and the future was very, and everything had changed. I'd become accustomed to the ways of doing everything in Thailand, and then suddenly I'm in a very modern city, and one of the biggest in the world, and I used to be terrified going on the underground. I mean, when going down Hampstead underground station, it's you have to go down and down like you're going into hell. And all these crowds of people trying to get on these trains. I remember being quite frightened by the activity. And it was there, and then I was walking down Haverstock Hill where the Vihara was one afternoon, and suddenly the sound of silence, suddenly it stopped me, like it attacked me. I was attacked by it. And I was nonplussed, you know, so suddenly I remembered this. And it's very interesting how one's spiritual life develops, because at the time that I came to live in England, it seemed to me this emptiness was becoming stronger, you know, practice. It was very strong. But living in Thailand, living in the tropical climates, they're very noisy. So you've always got and living in jungles, and there's always insects and things buzzing, so you have this incessant kind of background noise from the insect world. But in London, you know, in the winter time, it's very, very still. And so I began to really appreciate the stillness. And even though people think London is very noisy, Ajahn Chah himself said, "This is a very quiet city." Because before, the week before we came here, we'd been in Bangkok, which is a very noisy city. And for one thing, either it being so far north, there's a lot of natural stillness and silence here. And last year when I went up to the North Pole, I've always had this kind of, it started back in 1977 in Hampstead, having this kind of wish to go up and live at the North Pole, or at least visit. And so somebody, a friend of mine, Richard Smith, made this possible. We spent a week there in Svalbard, this island north of Norway. But also it was quite, because it is so still and silent, you know, the further north you go into the Arctic. But this stillness is innate with us. I mean, it's, if we have to go up and live at Svalbard, then that would be one thing. But not many people would be willing to do that, or could do it. But to find that within you, isn't it? That's the whole thrust of the Buddhist teaching, to find that unshakable stillness here and now, not depending on external conditions. Like if I had to find it every time to be still, I had to go to Svalbard, then that would... I'd somehow think, oh, this isn't quite right, you know. Buddha said nothing about Svalbard in the scriptures. And I didn't know anything about it either for most of my life. But this stillness then is what I call the sound of silence. So as you pay attention, you know, to recognize this sound of silence, it's in a relaxed state, you know, like people looking for, they think it's some super cosmic vibration, and they try to find it. So I've had people on retreats with me when I've talked about sound of silence, and they're very much trying to find it, you know, and so they desperately sit there trying to find it, and because they've conceived it as some kind of esoteric sound, and they don't see themselves. They see themselves as somebody that doesn't have it, and they've got to find it. So just the word "sound" itself is quite misleading, because there's a sound. You know, sounds come and go, and depend on conditions. But this is a continuity. This is like a stream. It has a stream-like quality. It has a continuity. It's a kind of naturally high pitch, almost electric, can be quite electric, and has a kind of vibrates, scintillates. Some people, you know, how you want to look at it. Some people call it a buzz, which gives it a kind of, like it's irritating. Buzzes is usually an irritation. Scintillating, sound of the stars, and that makes it ethereal. You know, so I mean, how you want to describe it. make it very kind of coarse and irritating or sublime. So I found it very sublime, actually, and it's a it has a continuity all the time. It's present, but whether I'm aware of it or not, it's something else. So in terms of an object of meditation, to recognize this is to open yourself to it. So the attitude towards this kind of practice is not concentrating the mind on something, but on relaxing, the sense of inner ease, of just being yourself, relaxed, open, and receptive. So sometimes in meditation techniques, they're highly developed on the level of concentration. So you see people going in, sitting on the floor, going in, sitting on the zafu, and they go like this. You know, because they're trying to concentrate the mind and shut everything out. Concentrate, Nongji, you have to focus on one thing and shut everything else off. So you absorb into the object you're concentrating on. In order to do that, you have to reject all other impingement, shut it away from you. But this is a real mindfulness style because it's a different kind of concentration. It's not focused on one point that you're trying to absorb into by excluding everything else. It's opening to the totality of this moment. And so that is a kind of formless reality. There's no form to it, where concentration practices, samadhi practices, are always, you know, on an object of form, something that you've been given or chosen to focus your attention upon. So in this way is relaxed. It's like relaxed attention, open, receptive, here and now. So it's like you're in a state, I like to describe it like this, wide open, rather than focused on an object. And then you're in a state of relaxed attention. You're not trying to become somebody who's relaxed. You know, I'm trying to, it's not a relaxation exercise. It's more of a suggestion, a gentle suggestion, rather than an imperative. Being just who you are in the present, open, receptive to whatever. And so your awareness then, in with consciousness, can pick up, can begin to notice this vibration. It's quite ordinary. It's not like some esoteric vibration from the heavenly realms that only the very gifted can get. And if you see it like that, then you'll give up. So what I'm trying to point, unless you very kind of have a, or you know, you have an inflated ego and see yourself self as being a very special creature. So the recognizing this, then it's because it is a receptive state. it's not analytical, you know. So it's where we begin, what I call the gate to the deathless. Now, this means a lot to me because usually when I give formal talks, I usually chant this Aparuta De Sangama Tatsatavara, the Buddha announced the gate to the deathless are open. And so this is a very powerful chant to me because it's, you know, the Buddha made this thing, the gate to the deathless. And of course these are metaphors, this is language again, but the gate to the deathless, what is it? You know, is it some kind of thing only the Buddha 2,500 years ago recognized, or it was more like, to me, it was like a proclamation, you know, it wasn't, I've found the gate to the deathless because I'm so special. It's saying, you know, here it is, you know, for everybody. It's a proclamation to the world. So then that gate to the deathless then, is, you know, when you see what is death, is all about your thinking, identity with your body, with your emotional habits, with all your attachments, isn't it? The fear of losing your loved ones, getting old, getting ill, dying, you know, the worry about the future, the regret about the past, all this comes through thought and through identity, through ignorance of Dhamma or the deathless reality. We are bound into the death-bound conditions. So this is why it is so frightening for us and why we worry and are anxious, because we're actually identifying with things that are going to fail us or disappoint us, that we're going to have to separate from anyway, that we invest so much of our attention in, and then it at the end of the day it's disappointing, it's worthless. So we can become cynics, or we just try to, or we take to drink, because forget about it all. Or we become meditators. And this is a much more skillful way, I guarantee, than the others. So this deathless is, then I connect this sound of silence, the sign of the deathless. Now I'm not making doctrinal statements, but this is just a way of reflecting on experience. What I'm saying is for reflection, it's not kind of Ajahn Sumedho dogma or doctrine. And I think it's more annoying than people making some kind of cult out of what I'm saying, because that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm just trying to awaken you and point to obvious, to that which is quite obvious that we tend to ignore and not notice. So then training myself, I began to notice that wherever I was, even in the Thai jungle, in the Thai forest, and when I was really aware, I could hear the sound of silence, the insect sounds, the noise of radios or things like that were not, you know, obstructions to it. I noticed very strongly how when one is by waterfalls or currents, streams or rivers, the sound of flowing water, the sound of silence is even the more stronger. You know, at Empress, I give retreat in Chiang Mai every year near a waterfall. It's terribly loud sound, this waterfall is a big waterfall, makes a lot of noise, and yet sound of silence is very much, you know, there. It's not, the sound of the waterfall does not diminish the sound of silence. So this pointing to that it's something we can rest in and relate to all the time wherever we are, whatever situation we're in. Like right now, sitting here in front of you, I'm fully aware of this sound of silence. I don't have to ask you to go out of the room. And I don't even have to stop talking or thinking. If I pay attention, it's there. It's here, here and now. So just by noticing this, by awakening to these realities, you begin to develop the wisdom faculty, or panya. Now, in panya, in Buddhist terms, it's the difference between, like, we're trained to be critical through thinking, through logic and reasoning. We know that what's good, what's bad, what's better, and what's the best, and what's worse and worst. And we know this: once something's right, something's wrong, male and female, day and night, all the dualisms of thought. And we have various preferences on this spectrum of dualism that we get very attached to. But wisdom in the word panya, this Pali word panya, is discernment. It's not a critical function. Now, when I discern this moment, that using the discerning ability, using the panya, satipanya at this moment, there's awareness of the way it is. It's discerning. It's fully present. Now, so it's not dismissing anything or any detail, or by putting any kind of judgment upon it as being trivial or banal or stupid or important or whatever. It recognizes, it can discern, but it's not critical. As soon as I start criticizing, then I'm back into thinking again. That this should be, that shouldn't be, this is better than that. So in this state of this natural state of discerning, then the awareness opens us to this. It's a gate to the deathless. Opens us to the deathless reality of through awareness. To be aware of the nature of the conditioned realm, which is changing, in that all conditions are impermanent. They arise and cease. So this discerning change is not judging it as something good or bad, it's just the way it is. When we see and really recognize the conditioned realm, the conditions that we're experiencing, both the bodies and the emotions, thoughts, then we're seeing them in perspective, not from attachment, not from preference or cultural biases or anything like that. We're beyond that. We're coming from the panya, or the wisdom faculty. So then we see that all conditions are impermanent, though this is not just something we project onto conditions, but discerning the reality of change in terms of experience here and now. And that unshakable awareness then, as you trust yourself to rest in this awakened, natural awakened state of being here and now, you find your strength in that awareness. No longer do you find yourself caught up in the endless attachments and judgments and that around the conditions you're experiencing. You can respond, you can act, there's spontaneity, but your relationship to it has changed from personal identity to one of wisdom, understanding the Buddha, in terms of Buddhist terms, the Buddha knowing the Dhamma, or the truth of the way it is. So these are ways that I've found helpful to me in my practice, and I know that you know, you know, the basic delusion is I am this person, I'm this body. And as long as my meditation practice operates from this assumption, then I never break through it. I'm stuck with the habits of I am this person who has to practice in order to become enlightened. So I've been encouraging people to begin to recognize even the assumption I am this person, I am Ajahn Sumedho. This is a creation in the present. And I am unenlightened and I need to practice so that I become enlightened. This is about time. This is about me being a person, because my personality is not enlightened, is it? I haven't an enlightened personality. It's pretty much the same as it was. I think a little better. But the personality, is a habit formation. So it's not a matter of suddenly I become an enlightened person. But there is enlightenment. There is, as more you trust in the awareness, that is the gate to the deathless. That is the ultimate truth. That is where you recognize that recognize ultimate reality or reality itself. And that's what you really are, you know. That's your true nature. It's Lungpa Cha called it going home. It's a natural state, and it's not mine. It doesn't belong to any religion even. It's not, nobody can put their label on it and claim it. And so it's not a matter of willfully trying to get it or become it, but in letting go of the delusions of self, to recognize, to awaken to the Dhamma, to see it and know it for yourself.